Here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission, our passion is wild. Tune in to our podcast, Call of the Outdoors, as we discuss all things related to wildlife, hunting, habitat, and conservation across the Keystone State. Hear from men and women who have a passion for the outdoors and who value and work to preserve our state's wildlife resources for current and future generations.
Hello and welcome to Call of the Outdoors, the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast. Holy cow, I can't believe it's the first week of November and we're sitting in here doing a podcast, but I couldn't ask for a better guest for a podcast when everybody has the rut going through their veins as Mr. Kip Adams from the National Deer Association. Hey, Kip, how are you today?
I'm doing good, man. And I guess that's because you and I are dedicated to our work, right? That's why we're not in a tree stand today. We're actually in the office doing some work.
That's not even right. You know what I mean? I've been thinking about this all day. You look outside and it's like, what am I doing in here? But I appreciate you coming on, you know, and kind of last minute. And I know we've been talking about doing this, but, you know, Kip, obviously we're proud that you're from Pennsylvania. You've been in this industry a long time. If you would, for our folks that are listening here to Call the Outdoors, just give them a little bit of your personal history and you know, where you came from and where you're at today.
Sure. I grew up in northern Pennsylvania, actually in Tioga County. Grew up on a dairy farm and you know, was introduced to the outdoors at a very early age. My dad hunted, my grandparents hunted, my uncles, my friends, everybody that I knew hunted. So it wasn't even a choice as a kid growing up, like, would you like to do this or not? It was just something you did. And I have loved every minute of it since I was a kid. Went to school at Penn State and then left the state for a decade. I went to New Hampshire and I got my graduate degree there, working with deer and moose. I knew that at an early age that I wanted to be a wildlife biologist and was very fortunate to get a good education there in State College and then go to New Hampshire. I left that, Matt, and I went south. I ended up working for the state of Florida, and I managed a wildlife management area right in the middle of Florida. That was as far from Pennsylvania in the north as I ever imagined being. I hadn't been south of Washington, D.C. in my life, and that's only because in sixth grade we went there for a class trip. As a deer biologist, it did me a world of good. I got to see deer in a different part of the world, got to meet deer hunters in a different part of the world. And what I realized is, you know what, deer eat a lot of the same things around the country, and they do a lot of the same things, you know, but it's the deer hunters that really make or break deer management programs. And so that did me a lot of good to see that and experience that. I always knew at some point I wanted to get back to the Keystone State. And so after 4 years in Central Florida, actually I got hired by New Hampshire Fish and Game. I went back to New Hampshire and ran the state's deer and bear management programs and loved that. And then that was about the time that my predecessor or my employer, QDMA, hired the first position in the Northeast. And that was based out of Pennsylvania. And I knew that had my name written all over it. So that was over 19 years ago now. I returned home. And I have been in Pennsylvania ever since. I get to travel the country for work. I have to live somewhere in the north, but I work in 20 to 25 different states each year with the state wildlife agencies and with hunters and landowners. And I'm very blessed. I love to do that. But, man, I am so proud to call Pennsylvania home and always look forward to getting back to Tioga County.
Well, I tell you, you know, myself, too, I left Pennsylvania and actually went to Iowa in my 20s, and everybody's like, why in the heck did you move back to Pennsylvania? There's something about this state that, especially when you're in the outdoors, that brings you back home, and I'm kind of the same way you did. I lived in the heart of giant whitetails and great turkey hunting and loved it out there, but I migrated back east and wouldn't change it for the world. But, you know, you said about QDMA, for those people that might not know out there, QDMA, Quality Deer Management Association. And any time that name came up, you know, in my past life, we worked with QDMA with Hunter Specialties and you've been around. When I thought of QDMA, I thought of Kip Adams because you've done so much legwork for that. But just talk a little bit about where we're at today with where QDMA is and is currently.
Well, just over a year ago, QDMA actually merged with the National Deer Alliance, and we formed the National Deer Association. So QDMA was born in 1988, And essentially what we have today is a strength in organization. And I'm super proud to be a QDMA employee for all those years. And 5 or 6 years ago, we had the first National Whitetail Summit. We've done this for turkeys. Folks have done these for ducks. They had never done them for whitetails.
Right.
So we hosted that. And what came out of that is stakeholders saying, man, we need a much stronger advocacy group for deer hunters. So at QDMA, we developed this advocacy arm that through a whole series of reasons, it ended up a separate organization, which was called the National Deer Alliance. The whole time that was alive, we worked very closely together on a bunch of issues. And long story short, when we hit the pandemic and, you know, people were out of work and we realized, you know what, this is a perfect time to have a second chance to do the right thing. So the two organizations merged. We kept QDMA's logo. We did change our name to the National Deer Association. But everything that QDMA stood for, all the educational programs and all those efforts, you know, we still have those today. So we are very much like the historical QDMA, but with a stronger advocacy arm to fight on a hunter's behalf. So so some people still call us QDMA, but technically we're now the NDA, which is the National Deer Association. But from my end of it, it's business as usual for what I do each day to fight for deer hunters and on behalf of deer.
Right, and it's so important. You know, the bottom line is, as hunters, as conservationists, we all need to work together. No matter if you love to hunt deer, turkeys, ducks, pheasants, I don't care what it is. As we take it into the future and we leave it to our kids, it's important that we're all on the same track. And if you love deer hunting and you love white-tailed deer, you know, obviously you want to check out NDA. Do you have your website memorized that you can just shoot it one time? And we won't stop there. We'll give the information again.
Sure. It's deerassociation.com.
Yeah, that is hard to forget, no doubt. Before we get any farther, because I've had too many birthdays, can you just give us one phrase about a white-tailed deer in your best New Hampshire accent?
Oh, you know what? My son, I have a 12-year-old son that now watches Northwood Law.
Right.
And, you know, it's that. So he will still look at, they talk funny, Dad. I said, I know. He said, did you talk like that when you were there? I said, I probably did a little bit.
I remember turkey hunting up there, and they'd be like, that turkey's across the brook. I'm like, what is a brook?
A brook, and of course, they put an R on everything. It's, you know, the whole New England dialect, you know, Massachusetts talks differently from Vermont, differently from Connecticut. Most of those, if you put it all together, it's not much bigger than the state of Pennsylvania, but they have four or five or maybe more different dialects, but there was an R at the end of a lot of words. So, you know, if you said, you know, hey, Kip, I got a good idea. Up there would be, hey, man, you know, I got a good idea.
Right.
And look at over there at that deer. And you got an idea on where we're going to. So definitely very unique to that state. And, you know, it's a cool part of the world for sure.
It really is. And you know, I spent a lot of time up there, you know, promoting turkey when turkey was new and just all over that country. And, you know, you'd have to drive 3 or 4 hours between places and you know, the chance of seeing a moose but like a lot of folks don't realize that our state here in Pennsylvania, we're so lucky to have that hunting tradition just running through our veins. And, you know, we're closing in and back up again to close to 900,000 hunters. You know, the state of Maine doesn't even have that many people in it, you know, and that when you think about it, it's pretty awesome. But, you know, with NDA, we do have a great relationship with the Game Commission and NDA. And if you just want to expand on that a little bit, I know we weren't going to talk about those three words, but, you know, we are working on some of the disease stuff and information, and you guys are a big, big asset to the Game Commission.
Well, thank you, Matt. We certainly appreciate the good working relationship that we have, and we've had that, you know, for well over 20 years. As much as anything, you know, we help provide additional promotion of some of the Game Commission stuff through education. And one of the huge things we work on is just making sure that people realize just the simple value of deer. Obviously, we're a huge deer hunting state. You know, there's more hunters per square mile in Pennsylvania than anywhere else. But there's also a lot of other people here. You know, and deer impact a lot of people, whether you hunt them or not. And so, you know, we want people to understand just how valuable deer are, whether you chase them with a bow or a gun or a camera, you know, or whatever the case may be. So we do a lot with you guys, you know, from an educational end and sharing information. And a lot of that evolves around just how important and how special white-tailed deer are.
They really are. And, you know, and we're getting ready to share some of this info, you know, here in the near future. We just got the brand-new economic impact of hunting in general in Pennsylvania. And, you know, a lot of folks including myself, it'll drop your jaw. You know, hunting is not only a recreation that we all love to do, and it's so necessary for, you know, the future of these animals, but it also affects so many things when you look at it economically. But let's get back to November, you know, because it's bow season, and like you said, we should be out there in the stand, and I want to talk a little bit about archery season, and especially from the science side, or the, you know, you're a diamond because you have the science and also are a hunter, and a good hunter at that. And a lot of folks, there's lots of things about whitetails that people don't know, and there's lots of things that all of us don't know or understand. But I want to talk about bow season and, you know, how it kind of evolves, and it happens so fast. We come in around the 1st of October, and already we're in November, and that whitetail's life has changed so much in just 30 days. And I kind of want to go there for, you know, there's a lot of people that have their freezer full and a set of antlers on the wall. We're going to talk about bucks quick. But, you know, early season to today, kind of talk about what a whitetail goes through, if you would.
Sure. You know, our season comes in a little later than many other states. So what happens is that late summer, deer are really still on this, you know, this feed and bed routine. And that is this by far the easiest time of the year to pattern a deer. As long as they have good cover close to where they have some good groceries, they really don't travel that far. So if you can get on a deer, and particularly, you know, we tend to see all these deer in the fields during the summer. If you live in an agricultural area or any place that you have open fields, through the month of September, it is a perfect time to really be able to pattern a deer and kill a big deer right off the bat. Now, our season, you know, always starts the very last Saturday in September or first one in October. So we kind of catch the tail end of that, you know, just the last few days, because what's happening, as soon as those antlers harden and they shed that velvet, everything in the deer's world begins to change. Hormone levels are rising. So suddenly all those bucks don't want to be together anymore. They're really transitioning from their summer to their fall, core area of their home range. Food sources are changing. So, you know, as hunters, we think, man, we're watching them in the field and all of a sudden they're not there. What happened? Well, partly is there's a lot of changes going on in the deer's world, but partly it is all of us hunters are hitting the woods at the same time as well. You know, and deer are a lot better at reading our behavior than vice versa. You know, so suddenly, you know, everybody's out hanging stands and checking stands, riding, and they're doing all this. So we alert deer, you know, so quickly to, hey, here we come. And so all that changes. So during that month of October, it can start extremely, extremely hot. And then a lot of people through the month, oh man, you know, I'm just not seeing much. Well, partly it's because they're not where deer were, you know, a month ago. Partly because deer have greatly increased their travel area, you know, as they're leading up to start breeding. So October, some of October can be a slow month for folks. But man, when you get to the end of it, and particularly where we are right now, you know, I always think here where we are is, you know, Halloween really flips the switch where hunting has been building and building, and now it gets really, really good.
Yeah, they let their guard down. Those big bucks, and even, you know, you think about it, the more birthdays they have, it's a lot like human life. I mean, the older you get, you don't want to maybe not be around as many people. And, you know, if you were on the dating scene at 45 or 50, you dang sure didn't want to be around other guys that were better looking than you. It's kind of like bucks. I mean, they want to get out there and get away from competition, or keep competition away, you know, as we head into this phase that we're in right now, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, they know that it's becoming the time of the year, you know, where more does are coming into heat, you know, they're increasing the amount of the core air that they use. They're moving more during the day. So, you know, lots of reasons that now we can cross paths with them. But even if you don't see them while you're hunting, this is the time of the year where suddenly, you know, you're seeing them out along the road more getting hit. You're seeing them in fields. So even if you don't see them while you're hunting, they're just much more viewable than they were a couple of weeks ago. And that alone gets hunters excited.
Yeah, I think, you know, and taking it to where we're at today, you know, that first week in November, you know, if you have some time, you know, we're coming up this particular week, towards the end of the week, the temperature is really going to fall. And you're looking at, you know, that moon that dropped last week. And I always use that, we called it the harvest moon where I grew. I don't know what you really call it, but, you know, that last full moon, and all of a sudden these does are starting to come into heat and buck activity is just going through the roof. But in this time of year, as a hunter, if you're hunting big bucks, it only takes about 5 seconds for everything to come right. So the more time you can put in that stand, the better it is. I mean, yeah, we all get hungry and want to get out, but like if you have 2 or 3 days to hunt this week or just Saturday, man, if you can stay in there as long as possible, especially up into the morning, you know, 10, 11, noontime, those bucks, they don't have a watch. This is that time of year where they're out trying to find girlfriends any second they can.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when on TV and in magazines, you know, we make it sound like the rut is just the most explosive thing in the world, and all you got to do is get out there, and there's activity all over. And what I tell people is, hey, now remember, that may happen, but let's go into this with realistic expectations. You know, November can be an awfully quiet time to sit as well if nothing is going on right in your area. I've had plenty of sits in November where, you know, I didn't see anything.
Right.
But the cool thing about it is that all can change in an instant. So I tell people, you know, once we hit this time, if you can go hunting, go and stay on stand as long as you possibly can. You know, it can be the most incredible time of the year, and or it can be very quiet. But if it is quiet, hey, keep hunting, because at any second, it all can change and turn into the most explosive time of the year. So this is the time to not give up. This is the time to go every second you can and stay as long as you can.
Right. You know, and you know, it just takes that one doe that's in or about to come in that can all of a sudden you got $5 circling you, and you think it's like it's the magical day you've always been waiting. Every once in a while, those days happen out there. And you know, we on social media, we see it all the time where people, well, that's pretty slow down here. But like you said, you don't know what's happening right over that ridge, you know, or over that mountain. You know, if the first doe that pops and they can smell it a long way off, you know, there's something going on somewhere, no doubt about it.
Yeah. A good example, and this really solidified this in my mind, man. This is several years ago now. I was hunting on us. It was November 6th, because this continues to be, you know, to this day, my favorite day of the year to hunt. And this year it's on a Saturday, which is good that it's not on a Sunday here. But I was hunting on our farm, and I saw, it was, gosh, 9 or 10 bucks by noon that morning. It was crazy. And it was all because right after daylight, a doe and heat came right under my stand. So it literally was a parade of bucks all morning. And my best friend was hunting on our farm about 300 yards away. And I remember thinking, this is like the greatest day in the world. I'm having a good day. Scott's going to be having a great day. Well, we got together that night and I said, you know, what'd you see? And he said, I didn't see anything. It was terrible. I said, how could it have been terrible? It was like the best day all year.
Right.
Well, look, the very next day we were hunting again, same about 300 yards apart, and the roles are flipped. He had an unbelievable day and mine was extremely quiet. So, you know, that really impressed upon me, like, hey, even if, you know, you say, oh, it's going good here in Northern PA. Well, that might be going good. It is so specific, not even just property specific, but, you know, parts of a property. So that has stayed with me ever since. And, you know, if it's good, I enjoy the heck out of it. And if it's not good, hey, I still remain optimistic. Now, you know what? I might just be, you know, 100 or 200 yards off, or I might be just 2 minutes away from this doe coming through here, you know, and turning this all around for me. So that definitely helps keep, you know, your anticipation up and just your, you know, your ability to stay there a little longer. If it's a little rainy or cold or whatever the case is, just knowing that, you know, you don't want to miss it, because it literally can switch in an instant.
Right. Now there's no doubt about it. And, you know, you have to be open-minded when you're a hunter, and you know, some days everything rocks and rolls, and some days, like you said, there's nothing, but there's always something to listen to key in on. I mean, the sights, the sounds, and the smell. I mean, I'm going to say it. I love it. This, whether it's you're smelling the woods or you're smelling a buck that, you know, peed all over his hocks, that, I mean, as a deer hunter, it gives you goosebumps when you're out there. And you know, I agree 100%. And, you know, let's take it here for the next couple weeks. You know, generally, if we say the peak of the rut, obviously that's probably when the majority of the does are in that estrus period. Is that, am I correct when I say the peak?
That is, yep. And Pence, you know, you guys have all the data showing that, you know, the majority of does will be bred over, you know, a 7 to 10 day window here in early to mid November. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're talking about the actual peak is the actual peak breeding. So when does, you know, do conceive.
Right. So that takes us through most of bow season. I mean, you know, we end, I think it's don't quote me on this. Is it the 19th? Yeah. It's that Friday before bear season. That's when archery season ends. So, you know, we're lucky enough that we've got that extra week now and a Sunday in there as well. So we have the rut covered in archery season. And let's take it a step farther from the rut. Let's talk about post-rut. And that's, you know, really when gun season hits. And so many times, you know, things that you're out there in gun season, you know, we're always, when I was a kid, you were trained to try to get to escape routes and this and that, but you really have some of that rut to key in on too as well. And a lot of folks don't realize that. And I wanted to really hit on that part of it if we could.
Sure. And you're right. There still is some rutting activity going on. You know, most of the does are bred in that early to mid-November timeframe, but there's some that continue to be bred out, you know, even through January. So there's, you still have the opportunity to catch some of that. Especially if you're in an agricultural part of the state where our fawns tend to be a little heavier than the northern tier and, you know, where it's real mountainous. You know, if a fawn that's born this year hits about 70 to 80 pounds this fall, she will become sexually mature and will breed this year. And a lot of what hunters think of as the second rut, not really the second rut, oftentimes it's some of those fawns that are just hitting sexual maturity for the first time. It happens, you know, a month or so later often than the adult does. So we have a great opportunity in some places, you know, to catch on some hot rutting activity. And then if you have one of those deer that are in heat anywhere near you, it is really game on, because it's not like earlier where there's a lot of other does that are in heat too. You know, there's very few. So the odds are even better, you know, if you have an opportunity to hunt around one of those.
Right.
So that can certainly be some fun rut activity late.
Yeah, and those big bucks know that happens. That's the, you know, to me, they've been around a few deer seasons, and it seems to me like they're waiting for it. I've had a ton of luck the last 4 or 5 years in changing my mindset, and I love to hunt that second week of our rifle season, our firearm season, and I've seen a ton of rut activity. But I want to talk about something that you kind of hit on earlier, and I think it's so crucial, and it's for a lot of our folks, it's hard to comprehend, especially gun hunters, and you talked about cover and thickets, and I'd want to talk about how important they are to whitetails and your hunting strategy. You know, we all want to sit, especially gun season, we want to sit where we can see them. I mean, just human nature, you want to see about as far as you can see and as far as you can shoot, but to be honest with you, those thickets play a real important role in as a hunter and as a whitetail.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, deer need cover. And, you know, it comes down to this. You know, deer need food and they need cover. And if on your land or the place you go to hunt, you can only have one or the other, I would take cover every time, because deer need food, but they can get that at night. You know, they are absolutely going to have cover. And, you know, I grew up hunting in Pennsylvania like a lot of others, where you did want to see, you know, forever through the big woods. And but if you think about it, that's when there was almost no property that was off limits to hunting. Almost everybody, you know, did drive hunts and they were moving deer around. So deer were always being kicked back and forth. Well, that's very different from the way most people hunt today. You know, we often hunt singly today. You know, you're in a stand, you know, you try to disappear in the woods, you become invisible. We're not walking around, we're not bumping deer. So if they're not being kicked by one or other, your chances of seeing them are very low if you're in big, wide open woods. So cover is crucial to deer. They have to have it. And the cool thing is if they have good cover, they'll feel more secure to want to get up and move during daylight hours. So I am seeking cover out in almost every case when I'm hunting. You know, if you can combine that with food, that's even better, because you know where they're going to want to bed, and then you know where they're going to want to feed. But yeah, you're right, Matt. You absolutely want to have cover in most cases to have good hunting.
That's spot on. You know, you try your best. You know, our state's sometimes a little difficult. The nooks and crannies and hills and hollows that we have to play the wind, you play the wind to the best of your advantage, you know, because that whitetail's living by its nose every day, especially as they get more birthdays. And those old does are, to me, especially, you know, November, those old does are a lot cagier than old bucks, because they're going to pick you out if you make a mistake.
You got that right.
So a couple things, and then I want to get any special Kip Adams tips or tricks, because I always love to do that, and I'm sure you have one. But I want to talk about, when we talk about food, and, you know, we have a banner acorn crop this year here in central PA. I mean, you can't, it's like walking on marbles. I've seen great mass crop, but this year is something that has to go down in history, history books. But, you know, when you think about that, you know, like, oh, I got great acorns, or I got, you know, soybeans in the summer. What? Let's talk about a whitetail's diet and the necessities, even in the browse situation, because a lot of people don't know everything that, I mean, a deer, his diet consumes of, but things that they absolutely need pretty much every day of their life.
Yeah, with whitetails, they have been seen to eat well over 600 different items.
Wow.
And part of that is just because it allows them to be so adaptable to any environment that they're in, but then also to really be able to take advantage of certain food that's, you know, available at a certain time, or, you know, just the highest quality parts of that plant that's available. So like where you are with an awesome acorn crop, I tell you, we had a terrible acorn crop.
I've heard that.
And where I am. And very few red oak, very few white oak acorns. Chestnut oak acorns are decent, but we're way down. Now, some people look at it, oh my God, like, what are the deer going to eat? Well, this is one of the reasons they eat such a variety of plants and parts, you know, so that they can always capitalize on what is there.
Mm-hmm.
From an acorn standpoint, though, if acorns are falling, you know, deer are going to key in on them. They love acorns. They don't have to have them. There are places, you know, think of Kansas, South Texas. You know, there are some unbelievably good whitetail places to hunt, you know, that don't even have an overstory tree, you know,
right,
let alone an acorn. They don't need acorns, but where you have acorns and when they are abundant, you can count on deer absolutely being there. You know, deer love them, you know, high in energy or high in, you know, fat content for deer. They're going to use them. So from a hunting end, you know, we can use that to our advantage to take advantage of where those acorns are actually falling.
Right, but in order, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I, by no means, when it gets to the biology side, I have kind of that hunter's mentality, but in order to digest that food, whitetails need browse. Is that correct?
They need to be able to digest any specific food. They have to have the right bacteria in their stomach,
okay,
to be able to do that. So that's why deer always eat a variety of plants. So they always have the option to transfer from one food source to another. So if deer ate only acorns, they would die. They couldn't do that. So you're right. They're going to eat acorns. They're also going to eat some browse, you know, and any other green stuff that they can, any other forbs. So, you know, they want to eat other things as well. Perfect example is soybeans. You know, there's probably nothing that deer like more than soybeans, but deer can be standing in a soybean field eating those leaves, just, you know, having, you know, the time of their life. And if acorns start falling, they're going to go eat acorns as well. So,
yeah, that's
so they. It's not just one thing. They're going to eat multiple things. So, yeah, there's never going to be a single thing that they're keying in on.
Right. So just I'm going to go to a negative side here real quick, because it's something that we face every year, and we keep trying to push this home, and that is, and, you know, especially Tioga County, or, you know, even down here, Dauphin or Perry, you know, it gets to be Perry, we can't because we're in a DMA, but, you know, it gets to be January, and you look out and you think, man, these deer are starving to death, and they're hungry. There's no doubt about it. But people start dumping corn out there in the winter months. And can you just explain from the scientific side, either side, you know, the issues that can create?
Yeah, this is a big deal, and it's a hard one sometimes for folks to understand, because it seems like the most natural thing in the world. Man, if I put food out, it's going to help deer. But in the deer's world, that's actually not true. And in many cases, if we try to feed them in the winter like that, particularly with something like corn, we're doing them a lot more harm than good. And we talked earlier about New Hampshire. You know, I saw this a bunch in New Hampshire. What happens is deer actually survive winter very similar to the way a bear does. They get as heavy as they possibly can during the fall, and then they live off that tissue fat during the winter. Now, obviously, they don't hibernate like a bear, but they live off that fat. Research that we did at the Deer Research Facility when I was in New Hampshire showed that adult does get about 50% of their daily energy from their fat. Even if they have access to high-quality food, they use that, because that's how deer evolved. They evolved to get fat and then live off it.
That crap ain't working for me, I can tell you that right now. Mine's like 20 years worth, and I'm not evolving.
Gotcha. So the way deer survive winter, once we get into winter, is cover is key. Food is not key in the winter, it's cover. We want to just allow them to slow the use of that fat. So as we just talked about, deer eating all these different foods and having to have the right bacteria to digest them. When deer shift to a new food source, they have to eat it for 1 to 2 weeks before their stomach gets adjusted to be able to pull the nutrients out of that. So what you never want to do is shock a deer system and go from a low quality food immediately to a real high quality food. That doesn't happen in nature. That never happens. It all transitions slowly. But in the winter, when deer already browse, very low quality, but enough for deer to survive, when somebody dumps corn out, which is really high energy food, that can shock a deer system and in the worst case, kill the deer almost immediately. Or if it doesn't kill it immediately, it still can cause all types of acidosis in the deer stomach and end up killing it long term. So it's way better to put those efforts out there in the fall and make sure deer go into winter nice and fat, but then do not actually put corn out and feed them during the winter.
Yeah, it's hard for us as humans it's hard to fathom that, especially somebody that doesn't understand, you know, a lot of the science. Because, you know, when I was a kid, you always had your feeder out there. But, you know, as I've learned later in life how bad it is, and we all need to do a more concerted effort to help people understand that that's not really a great thing to do. Those deer are going to survive. And if they don't survive, and we didn't harvest enough animals, our population's a little out of check. And that's really what hunting is. It's to keep that population sustainable. And so we don't have those winter kills like we used to when you and I were kids, Kip. And I know last winter in your country, there was a little bit of a winter kill from my understanding.
Yeah, it's a little west of me. I live just east enough that I'm outside of the lake effect, you know, coming off of Erie. But a little west of me, you know, where you get an average of 200 inches of snow a winter, you certainly can get some of that winter kill. Most of Pennsylvania doesn't get much of it. You know, we're very fortunate there. We're just in a really good spot geographically relative to where whitetails live. But something else folks need to think of, too, with regard to feeding, and we saw this all the time in New Hampshire, is where people feed deer, you know, it congregates deer into these smaller areas, makes them way easier for coyotes to kill, makes them easier for feral dogs to run and chase, more get hit on the roads. So, you know, people put food out and think they're helping, and in many cases around those areas, shoot, more deer end up dying because of it.
Right.
So,
and
that's important for folks to understand.
Yeah, and the fact if there is disease prevalency in that herd somewhere, you're helping continue to spread that. And, you know, when they congregate as well. And you know, that's just something that we're really going to get after here, you know, here at the Game Commission, is just trying to continue to educate. And we need hunters and people, wildlife enthusiasts, to realize that late winter feeding is really, really bad. And on the turkey side of things, you know, and biologically speaking, I can't answer this question, but I know that turkeys are real susceptible to disease or you know, killing them if the corn has certain types of mold on it. You know, a lot of states, Oklahoma is a state where baiting is legal to hunt whitetails, and their turkey population is way under goal. And, you know, you hear some rumors they're thinking they're relating it to a lot of the feeding of corn out there to their deer, and it's sitting, you know, stuff that gets sitting there and growing this, you know, bad bacteria, bad mold, that it might be having an effect on turkeys. I don't know if that's, you know, there's any truth to that. I know they're studying that and looking at it as we speak.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. And that's absolutely true. They're aflatoxins. That's what's killing them. And, you know, they don't really harm deer, but that's the mold that's getting in there, the fungus that kills songbirds, and it wipes turkeys out. It's really bad for turkeys.
Yeah, and I mean, personally, whitetails are my second favorite, and I have to kind of go with that old spring gobbler for my first favorite. So I don't want to see anything happen to either of them. But let's get back to the good news here, Kip. I know that if there has to be one of those tricks or tips that you could help a fellow Pennsylvania hunter out that they might not realize or think about, in whether we're talking about, you know, here at the end of archery season or going into rifle season, that something that we could pass along today.
You know, I used to think that, man, the deeper in the woods I got, the better it was. And, you know, the farther that I got away from everything, the more deer I'd see. And that certainly was successful for me over the years. But I will say this, when my kids started hunting with me, or when I started taking them, I guess before they could hunt, you know, I had them in chest packs and backpacks, and suddenly we're hunting out of ground blind. and I just couldn't get as deep into the woods. What I realized, Matt, is, you know what? If I started hunting kind of the fringes of areas and then just worked my way in deeper as the season went, suddenly I started seeing a lot more deer continually throughout the course of the year. And I think what was happening is, you know, early in the season when I was headed like way back in the woods and I was alerting deer to my presence such that, you know, little stands that I was in, you know, they may be really good once or twice, but then after that, deer were really on to me. Well, when I started hunting from the outside in, I didn't spook as many deer, and I started having much better hunts through the course of the whole season. So I have really used that to my advantage over the last, I guess, about 10 years and realized that, hey, I am going to be super cautious about alerting deer to me being there, whether that's, you know, entering the stand or exiting it. But rather than go right into the middle of my timber and take those best stands first, I start on the outside and then work my way slowly as the season progresses into some more of those interior spots. Right now, as we get into, you know, peak movement and during the rut, it's time to start getting in there a little bit deeper. But I think if hunters do that, that's something that they can use to their advantage, because as soon as deer know they're being hunted, they become far harder to kill. And so that's something that I have used successfully for me and my kids and my other campmates over the years, or at least over the past decade. So something I'm glad to share with others, and hopefully that can help them get a little closer to a whitetail as well.
I love it. And, you know, it's, you know, for years, and I grew up in a family that still have some folks that are blood relatives. They hunt the same stand day after day after day, and they're like, I saw a lot the first day, and then the second week, I didn't see any deer. They must have moved. They didn't move. They just know you're there. And, you know, I always relate it back to human life. If somebody was, you know, trying to catch up with us, and they tried twice, and we caught them doing that, and we'd try to avoid that situation. And then a whitetail's the same way. It's out there. But, Kip, you know, on a good note to end this, because it's – and number one, thank you for joining us today in the middle of the best part of deer season. But where do you see the future of whitetails? If you had a crystal ball, I mean, this doesn't – nobody's going to hold you to it. I just want to get what you say, because I think you and I are close to the same age, and we've seen a lot of great stuff. And, you know, obviously there's some negative stuff out there with diseases. But if you had a crystal ball, where would you see the future in whitetails?
There's certainly a lot of things out there that are threats to deer herds today, but I'm an optimist, and I see a lot of good things on the horizon. Hunters are far more knowledgeable today than ever before about deer biology and deer management and how to enhance habitat for deer. So that's a great thing. We have some expanding deer populations in some areas. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we are super lucky. You know, there's not a single state in the country that kills more deer per square mile than we do. So we have lots of deer, lots of opportunities. Not that everything is all golden, for sure, because of, you know, disease and habitat loss and some other things. But hunters have always answered the call. You know, we have always stepped up to the plate and took care of the big problems. And I'm confident that we'll do that again. You know, we have more knowledge than ever before about this animal and how to protect it, how to ensure that we have healthy deer herds in the future. So, you know, we can get hunters on board to working with our state wildlife agencies, particularly from the disease end, because that's the biggest thing affecting us right now. If we can make that happen, I'm very confident that we're going to have huntable deer populations long into the future, and we'll maintain our strong hunting heritage here in the Keystone State.
Well, I couldn't think of a better way to end it. That's awesome. And we feel the same way. And we always say, you know, we all have to work together, and sometimes working at the state agency, people don't see the same views we do. But and I understand that everybody is entitled to their own opinion. But the bottom line is, we all can agree to disagree sometimes, and we have to work for a better ending. And I appreciate those words. Anything else that you'd like to add, Kip, before we sign off?
I'd just like to wish everybody good luck this hunting season, and make sure that they wear a harness anytime they get off the ground at a tree stand, and encourage them to take somebody new and share our wonderful woods with them.
Well, heck, I can't say anything better than that, but mm-hmm. I was going to say the same stuff, but that's exactly right. But the other thing, if you would, one more time before we sign off, would you hit your website for the National Deer Association?
Sure. We encourage anybody to go visit that at deerassociation.com.
Easy enough. Kip, we appreciate what you do with us here at the Game Commission, and we appreciate what you do for whitetail deer across the country. And I wish you would give your fellow coworker that was going to join us, Nick Penizzato, a very hard time because he's in a tree stand in Kentucky this morning and couldn't join us. Mm-hmm. And I hope he has bad luck today.
I guess we're both just a little jealous. He's a little luckier than we are today.
That's right. That's right. Well, Kip, thank you so much, and thank you for what you do, and stay in touch. Let us know how it goes, and this definitely won't be our last time here on Call the Outdoors together.
All right. That sounds good, Matt. Hey, good talking to you as always, and good luck to you, and reach out to me anytime I can help.
Thank you, sir. You have a good one. Now,
go
get in a tree.
You. All right, you too.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. As a way to say thank you for being a Pennsylvania hunter, the Pennsylvania Game Commission and OnX Hunt have partnered to offer you 20% off the number one hunting GPS app. Visit onxmaps.com and use the promo code HUNTPA. Each download supports the future of Pennsylvania wildlife and conservation. On behalf of the Pennsylvania Game Commission, thank you for tuning in. And we hope that every day of field is filled with memories to last a lifetime. We are committed to leave conservation and wildlife better for the future. And we hope you can tune in next time to the PGC's Call of the Outdoors.